Hey, this is DeRay. I'm going to pause for the people. In this episode, it's me, DR, Kai, and Miles talking about all the news that you didn't hear. And then I sit down with Anousheh Hussain to talk about her new book, The Pain Gap, How Sexism and Racism in Healthcare Kill Women. My advice for this week is to have the tough conversation, even when it's uncomfortable, even in its imperfection. Recently, I had a tough conversation. I knew it was the right thing to do. I was like working my way through it in real time, and it was imperfect, but important and necessary. And I feel like in our lives, there are a lot of things that we need to do and say that are imperfect, or waiting for the perfect thing, or we are trying to find the best way. And sometimes you just got to work through it. So go do the thing, have the conversation. 2021, the truth is always the best story to tell. Let's go.
Don't go anywhere. More Pods of the People's coming.
My news today is about Alzheimer's disease and other dementia in Black and Latina women. It turns out, and I did not know this until I read this article, that about 6 million Americans have dementia. Two-thirds of them are women. Black people are twice as likely to have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia compared to white people. Latino people are 1.5 times more likely. And even though there's an elevated risk for our communities, Black and Latino people are less likely to receive a diagnosis than white people. This is problematic for many reasons. As you can probably guess, that means that our access to treatment is limited. It means that we can't plan appropriately for our families, and lots of times it means worse health outcomes. Many of you know that these disparities come from systemic gaps. We have a lack of culturally competent providers, there are socioeconomic inequities, a mistrust of doctors, there are stigma about symptoms of dementia, education is not tailored to reach our high-risk communities, and there's a basic lack of literacy about memory health in the United States. Most of you think that loss of memory is a normal part of aging, but apparently it's not scientifically. And in the same way that your doctor can monitor your vital signs from year to year through your annual checkups, there are ways that you can monitor people's cognitive behavior year to year through their annual checkups. In fact, you need those baseline numbers to understand when people are in cognitive decline. Many people don't know that the annual wellness visit that is usually covered by your insurance, or at least the one that is covered by Medicaid, also covers a yearly cognitive assessment. But most people don't know about it, and so they don't access it. This is a huge issue because early detection actually provides the opportunity for early stage treatment. Family members and caregivers, who are usually Black and Latino women, need to know the warning signs to look for. They need to know what to do after diagnosis. And there are a number of clinical trials and new drugs that are available if you're able to diagnose in time. Early detection also plays a huge role in how people want to handle their affairs. You have the opportunity to plan financially, to plan legally, to plan for how you want your wishes to be carried out. One of the downsides of a dementia or an Alzheimer's diagnosis is that we often worry about a loss of liberty, autonomy over decision making. But the truth of the matter is, if we are not vigilant, then we see things happening like the family that is lifted up in this article, where a young woman, Aisha Atkins, was watching her mother cognitively decline. And she went to one doctor, and her mother was diagnosed as having menopause-related stress and prescribed antidepressants. Like many Black women in the healthcare environment, she did not feel seen or heard. And so over the course of 2 years, she got her mother treatment from other doctors. She saw a neurologist 6 months later at an Alzheimer's research center. They diagnosed her mom with suspected early onset Alzheimer's and prescribed a medication that actually worsened her symptoms. And it wasn't until 2 years after the first neurology appointment that she got the appropriate diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia, which is the leading cause of dementia for people under age 60. Her mom was 56 years old. And so if we are not watching out for our parents and our aunties, because I'm not that far away from 56 these days, then we miss opportunities to provide the kind of care that Aisha was able to give her mother. Unfortunately, the diagnosis came too late for her mother to really outline how she wanted to be treated. And Aisha ended up having to take care of her mother, to quit her job and reorient herself in her 20s and 30s to be able to take care of her mother. We love our family members. We all want to take care of them. And I brought this to the pod because I had no idea that women were more likely to suffer from dementia and Alzheimer's. And I sure didn't know that Black people and Latino people were 1.5 to 2x as likely to have Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia as compared to white people. And so I wanted to raise this so that when we see our family members not remembering, or when we see them not being able to do things that they used to do, that it's incumbent upon us to not just take people to the doctor and try to get the right diagnosis, but it's incumbent upon us to persist and persist and persist, because we know that the healthcare system is not designed for us and doesn't work with us. There's a ton of new research on Alzheimer's and other dementia-related diseases, and the Alzheimer's Association is working with the African-American community through outreach and partnerships with churches, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the National Association of Hispanic Nurses, the Black Nurses Rock Foundation. They are doing community outreach to be able to reach our mommies and our grandmas and our abuelas and our abuelitas to help them understand what we need to do. And I brought this to the pop because we need to be aware of these things.
Today, I want to show my respect for mystic and scholar Melanoma Patrice Somme. He passed away this week, and he was an amazing, prolific mystic, scholar, and he really did his work to really bridge a kind of an ancient African intelligence with a modern spin on it, and all of just looking at things with the modern world through that ancient African lens, rather. So really looking at what we were going through, what we were suffering through as African people, as Black American people, and really comparing it and critiquing it through that lens, and keeping certain traditions and ideas that are part of the ancient, specifically West African tradition, alive, and integrating intellectual ideas with spiritual ideas, and making both of those things worthy and necessary and wise. He was just one of my favorite people to favorite people to listen to. I never got to speak to him. He also really advocated for LGBT and queer identity, not in a way where it was with a parade, but through his text and through conversations, really advocated that a lot of the things that we see as homophobic and transphobic and queerphobic, these are new things that we learned through colonialism. And he was talking about that since the late, mid, and early 90s. He was talking about how our gaze when it comes to gay folks and queer folks and trans folks is really warped by European colonialism. And we had and queer folks, LGBT folks, had a space in African tradition. One of his, one of the things that he said in one of his essays and interviews that I wanted to read was this as follows. I don't know how to put it in terms that are clear enough for our audience that I think needs as much understanding of this as this gender issue as people in this country do, but at least among the Dagara people, gender has very little to do with anatomy. It is purely energetic. In that context, a male who's physically male can vibrate female energy and vice versa. That is where the real gender is. Anatomic differences are simply there to determine who contributes what for the continuity of the tribe. It does not mean necessarily that there's a kind of line that divides people on that basis, and that is something that also touches on what has become known here as gay or homosexual issue. Again, in the culture that I come from, this is not the issue. These people are looked on essentially as people. The whole notion of gay does not exist in this indigenous world. It does not mean that there are not people that there who feel that way, that certain people feel in this culture that has led them to be referred to as gay. Again, Melanoma really was just investigating and interrogating gender and sexuality and and really pushing against the binary that we often take as just how things are. And it's just not how things are. This is something that has been projected onto us. And I found it so affirming that somebody who was a straight Black man who was also really invested in African culture and mysticism was also not homophobic and not transphobic. I think we, you know, even on the internet, monikers like Hotep and things where we automatically think if a Black man is maybe too inside of their Afrocentric culture or mysticism, that it probably also comes with a dose of transphobia and homophobia and queerphobia. But his did not. It came with expansive queer politic, and it came with love, and he'll be sourly missed. And I know that we were all, everybody who's been touched by his work will continue to lead his legacy in creating technologies and ideas and theories that fit the African past, present, and future.
So my news is about Las Vegas, and it was in the Washington Post. It's titled, Sex Trafficked Kids Are Crime Victims. In Las Vegas, they still go to jail. And it really blew my mind. You know, what happens is in Las Vegas, there's still a large economy of sex trafficked kids of all gender identities. So trans kids, queer boys and girls, like straight boys and girls, all types of kids are being trafficked. And by kids, I mean under 18, are being trafficked in Las Vegas. And what happens is that it is often easier for the police to arrest the child than it is for them to get the trafficker. And it's dangerous for the kid to get arrested, because if the kid gets arrested and they don't cooperate or whatever happens and they get released, it's actually really dangerous for them when they go back to the actual trafficker, the John, because it's this idea that you should have actually made a set of decisions so the police can find you, right? But the thing that really blew my mind is that in Las Vegas, historically, and actually still today, as the article notes, is that the strategy is to arrest the young people, because so the system is like the arrest makes it easier to put you into services, right? That like by arresting young people, that's how they get away from the person trafficking them. That's how they get access to resources. That's how they get connected to advocates. And it's like, wow, what a world that we live in where people really do think that putting children in cages who are victims of sex trafficking is the best solution. And Las Vegas passed a law that said that in 2022, there's going to be a new way to do this. There's going to be essentially a dedicated space for trafficked kids to go so they can enter the recovery into society process or the reinstitute into society and away from the trafficker. And there'll be a dedicated set of resources. But, you know, it's wild. The judge, one of the main judges who deals with these cases, he acknowledges that, like, the arrest strategy doesn't work. The advocates are like, there are a million ways that you can get resources without arresting kids. But I had no clue. And, you know, the other thing that is really tragic is that there are a set of kids who, you know, they don't cooperate or they're not from Nevada. So they go back, they get sent back to California, or they can't get reconnected with their parents. They get put into the foster system, or they sort of disappear again off the grid. It's like, I hadn't considered the subset of young people who are sex trafficking victims that we have literally just essentially decided not to build an infrastructure for. Like, we just didn't. And they are falling through the gaps. They are remaining victims. If we are throwing them in a jail cell and calling that the best gateway to services, if the transition away from the trafficker back into their home or reintegration is through foster care or other processes not designed to deal with this issue, you know, it talks about in a California community that there are like two foster care programs that even specialize or have any sort of degree or specialization in sex trafficked victims. And this is not an area that I had known much about before. It's not something that we'd focused on in our organizing. And really, it blew my mind. I just didn't know anything about the economy of sex trafficked kids and the relationship between that and how the police funnel kids into jail cells as a mechanism of getting services. And it's like, there has to be a better way. So I left this with way more questions and, you know, I want to find somebody to bring on the pod to be an expert to talk about this in Nevada. So I'm excited. I'm excited to find somebody to help us all think better about what solutions look like. But this is one of those things that like impacts a subset of young people and it doesn't make the national conversation often, but it is important. So I wanted to bring it here to share.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
Let's get into a new shape saying. Now, the thrill of the American dream can be misleading, especially when it pertains to quality of healthcare, specifically quality of healthcare for women and birthing mothers in the country. She uses her book, The Pain Gap, to recount her memory as a Bangladesh native giving birth in the U.S. and almost losing her life on the delivery table. Despite her work as a feminist policy analyst focusing on women's health legislation, she was, for the first time, exposed to how dangerous the American healthcare system could be up close and personal. I knew she was jolted out of her misconception of comfort and safety within U.S. hospitals, and she wanted to learn more about the millions of other women facing a similar plight. And here's the book. Following in the footsteps of feminist manifestos such as The Feminine Mystique and Rage Becomes Her, The Pain Gap explores real women's tales of healthcare trauma and medical misogyny with this meticulously researched, in-depth examination of the women's health crisis in the U.S. How can folks be empowered to bring about the healthcare revolution women need? How do we do it? Let's find out with Anushay Hussain. Here we go.
Anushay, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
I am so honored and I am a big fan. So thank you for having me.
So one of the reasons why I'm excited to talk to you is that I get to learn about a set of things that I don't know as much about. And your experience was so interesting to me. Can you start by telling us how you got involved in policy, how you got involved in the work around women's health? Like, what was your entrance into that work? And then I want us to talk about the book.
You know, when you get to a point where when you write a book or you get to a point in your work where you have, where it starts to kind of make sense, you know, like everything that happened in your life, all the things that have happened that have led you to this point, when it's happening to you, none of it really like makes sense. Like how I got into the policy world, how I ended up working on women's health, had nothing to do with this dream I had to write this book. But now everything has kind of come full circle. You know, I mean, I grew up in Bangladesh, which is Dhaka, Bangladesh, which is right next to, it's a small country right next to India, but we're kind of this huge development star. You know, we're kind of known for empowering women. We're the country that gave birth to microfinance and Grameen Bank. So I grew up, you know, watching America really implement, create, develop, and successfully implement, you know, safe motherhood initiatives in Bangladesh, really kind of introduce the concept of public health. And I kind of grew up thinking that healthcare in America was like the movies, you know, just amazing. And I actually, amazing and always successful. I mean, when we were growing up, even though I grew up very privileged, you know, when we were growing up, when we heard that somebody was going to the States for any kind of treatment or medical care, you know, we were just like, wow, that person is, you know, is going to live. That person has a real shot. And then, of course, you know, you fast forward to almost, I mean, I'm 41 now and my daughter is 10. And so you fast forward, you know, like 2 decades and I almost died giving birth in America while I was a feminist policy analyst in Washington, D.C. I was working on global health legislation, and I had no idea not only that it was possible to die giving birth in the world's richest democracy, but that America was and still is in the midst of a maternal health crisis. So it's a very ironic story. And the reason I started working on Capitol Hill on legislation in the first place was because this was back in 2001, 2002. And so the U.S. had just gone into Afghanistan. And, you know, that issue of Afghan women's rights, and there was so much political will at that time, it was right at the start of the U.S. invasion. I really, really wanted to be a part of that movement.
I had no clue about the history of Bangladesh in terms of, you know, the birthplace of microfinance and all those other things. So now, why is the book called The Pain Gap?
The reason it's called that is because you, as you know or may not know, there's a lot of gaps that women have to deal with. There's a gender gap. There's a pay gap. There's a credibility gap, but there's also a pain gap. Women's pain is not believed, not taken seriously, and often dismissed and undertreated. So that's why it's called the pain gap.
And, you know, I think about Serena. Like, I think about Serena in the hospital. It's like,
yes.
Even with money and fame, people, they still didn't believe her about her own pain.
The Serena Williams story is so important. And you guys can edit this however you want, but... you know, when she went public with her story, people were so shocked, right? Because the understanding is, the thinking was pre-pandemic, where we could still, you know, debate if racism was real or if racism exists. You know, now I think the pandemic has really kind of made that race, the role of race in healthcare and everything in America kind of undeniable. But when that story came out, people were so shocked, not necessarily women of color, but other white people were so shocked. Because the understanding was always that Black people were doing something wrong, right? Because what I have found out, it took me a good 10 years to figure this out, that America's maternal health crisis is actually a Black maternal health crisis. You know, white women are dying in childbirth, but in America, women of color are 2 to 3 times more likely to die than their white counterparts. But Black women, it's always starkest between Black and white, those two groups. And the Black women are 243% more likely to die giving birth in America. And we know now that education, fame, money, nothing will protect you from the color of your skin. Because, I mean, the Serena Williams story came out, and she is like, what, the top athlete in the world? She's paid millions of dollars to know her body. She was like, I have a blood clot. Like, she knew it. She was coughing. You know, she was being dismissed. And finally, they took her in, and then they found a huge blood clot. She was taken back to surgery. But she could have very easily died, and it happened to Beyonce as well. But now we actually have the stat that Black women who are college educated are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth in America than a white woman with a high school degree. So, you know, before you could be like, oh, you know, Black people are not educated, or it's because people of color, X, Y, and Z. There are some health issues like hypertension, anemia, yes, that is very specific to African-American women, but that it's racism, not race, that is killing women of color in America.
I want to start with the first chapter. And why do you talk about your mom and your nanny? Like, why are they the way that we enter this story with you?
Well, it's so hard to write a book. And I really had to fight to write this book in the middle of a pandemic with my husband, who I love so much. But yeah, you know, to have that uninterrupted time as a mom. And when I finally got it, I kept thinking that the story and my journey with maternal health, working on it, started with me and my birth story. But once I got that quiet that I needed to write the book, I remembered my nanny. And I don't know why I get so emotional about it now, Jeri. Like, I came to the States when I was 18 to go to college, and I never told anyone this story. And when I started writing the book, it just came out. And now whenever anyone asks me about her in an interview, I get so emotional. But I also feel like she would have gotten a real kick knowing that I put her in the opening chapter of my book. So that's just where my mind went. That's right away where my mind and my heart went. And that chapter came out pretty fast, you know?
I wanted to know too, you know, in, I think the third chapter, you talk about that you talked to over 100 women in preparation for the book. What was that like? Like, what surprised you? What were you like, wow, this is a theme that I wouldn't have known was a theme? Like, how are those conversations? And you know, obviously great. The book concludes.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, as you can tell, I love to talk, but I really love women's stories. And what shocked me right off the bat was how everyone had a story. Like, that's where I started. I started this book by talking to women. And I was shocked at how every woman has a story. Every woman has a medical misogyny story, has a sexist story, dealing with their doctor, not being believed, you name it. And then every woman of color has a sexist and racist story. So then I realized that this is actually a kind of a scandal that no one is talking about and women aren't really talking about because we know we're not going to be believed.
Until your book. Here we go.
Yes, exactly. Until my book. This is a real conversation starter.
Now, one of the things too that a lot of things that were new to me, you talk about clinical trials in the book. Can you tell us why, what is the lesson there?
What I really love about my book, and it happened very naturally, was that it goes, from my personal stories to women's stories to there's a lot of hard data in the book. There's a lot of research that went into this book. And what I really love now is that a lot of things, not love, but I'm so happy because a lot of things that women have been saying or people of color have suspected for a really long time, we now have the research to back it up. Which we didn't before. There still needs to be a lot more research. But I was absolutely mind blown about the systemic way and women have been excluded from clinical trials and medical trials in the world's richest democracy. I mean, it is infuriating. And also it's just mind blowing. I cannot believe it. I can't believe people are not talking about this all the time. And while I was getting infuriated finding all this research, that, the NIH, the National Institute of Health, there was no mandate to include women in their research until 1991. And even then, even now, there's big problems. It hasn't gotten any better. And they are not also, forget women, it's not even required to be diverse, racially diverse. So the standard for health in America is a white, middle-aged man. And it has serious health consequences for everybody. But of course, in my book, I'm focusing on women. And while I was writing about it, the COVID vaccine trials happened. And we saw women be systematically excluded, again, pregnant women, from the trials of, perhaps the most anticipated vaccine of our lifetime. And it's a very interesting thing. There's kind of an obsession, I feel like, in American medicine with protecting the unborn baby or the fetus and a complete disregard for women's health and the living, breathing woman. And I mean, I think I went on TV a few times just being pregnant women want to be tested on. We don't have a vaccine for everybody until we have a vaccine for pregnant women. And now we know that all the vaccines are fine. And they didn't, kill the baby, kill the woman or anything. So they offered the protection that women needed, but women really had to find out on their own, right? I feel like it was a kind of violence against women that we didn't prioritize pregnant women and pregnant people in the clinical trials for the COVID vaccine.
So we covered it on the pod is that the test dummies, they're not women's weight for car crashes.
So they only
test, the dummy is a man, which is why women have historically died because, we don't test it. And what about the trust gap? You talk about the trust gap. Can you explain that to us and why the trust gap or knowledge gap, why they come up in play and, how do you close them? Or is this just something we study?
The really important thing about my book is I'm not talking about cancer or AIDS. Everything is solvable. It's a really big problem that women are not believed. We have a trust gap and a credibility gap. We are not believed about our bodies. We're not believed when we say we've been raped. We're not believed when we say we've been harassed. We're not believed when we say we're in pain. It's the default to think that women are crazy, being hysterical, imagining it, and not telling the truth. It's really fascinating. One of the most radical things I propose in the book is believe women. Believe women. Believe women of color. When we tell you we think something's wrong, when we tell you we're in pain, so much of things go wrong in the healthcare world and in the world of women's health because we're not believed or taken seriously. So it was actually Maya Dusenberry who in her book Doing Harm about, how lazy science and misogyny and sexism are basically killing women unnecessarily. She's the one who identifies that there's a trust gap and then there's a knowledge gap. There's also a serious lack of research done on women's health. I mean, going back to the crash test dummies for cars, Ambien was only tested on men. And then they found out that women take an additional 8 hours to metabolize the medicine. So it was really dangerous for women to drive. on Ambien. They have to pull it from the market and change the dosage and, you know, put that warning on. I mean, that's really dangerous stuff. And, you know, there's a whole section about heart disease as well, but, you know, I can talk about that later. But yeah, I mean, it has serious consequences and serious impact on women's health, the lack of research.
If people want to, now what, the two questions that we ask everybody, and the first question is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Oh gosh, I have so many. I'm so nerdy. I like love quotes and I keep quotes and things people tell me. Well, I think it has to be something, you know, my dad always gives the best advice. I wish somebody had told me just to, you know, shut up when I was younger and listen to everything he says. Well, a lot of things have stuck with me, but one thing that he said that really sticks with me is be on time. He always said, and you know what? He's like working in government. He's like such a big kind of political icon in Bangladesh. And he is always on time. He's never late. And we are like culturally always late. Like Bengalis are kind of notorious for coming like 2 hours after whatever time you give them. So I love that he instilled that in me. He said that he actually said that's the key to success, be on time.
There are a lot of people who are like, I did it all, right? I emailed, called, testified, read her book, read his book, read their book, read all the things. And the world hasn't changed in the way they wanted it to. What do you say to those
people? Yeah. Oh. You know, it is such a politically depressing time. It can be. But I think what I love so much about America is if you see something, if you want to do something and it's not being done, or if you have an idea and you don't see it, you too. And I don't think it's ever been a better time to, you know, be proactive. I mean, look, start a campaign. You know, see what you need, and it doesn't have to be political. It could just be advocacy. So much is, I mean, look at the stuff that you and I talked about today. I didn't know so much of it even last year. So I think information is, you know, and I know information and knowledge is power. So a lot of it is just, you know, if you're passionate about something and if you feel like there's an issue that more people need to know about, then be that person, you know, be that leader, do it and inform and educate as many people as you can. You know, I know it's so cheesy, Gandhi's quote about being the change that you want to see in the world, but it's really true. And that's what I love about advocacy and just being like such a big feminist that I am. So do it, you know, create and bring about that change that you want to see. Because, I mean, what's the alternative? Are you going to wait for it to happen? Wait for somebody else to do it? No, thanks. No, thank you.
Well, we consider you a friend of the pod. It's been great to talk to you and everybody. You need to go get the pain bath right now. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning into Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Lanz. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, Diarra Ballinger, and Miles Johnson.